This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. During the 1940s, the nation was experiencing its third resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan produced local tension in communities where they were active, but few people had the courage to speak out against the terrorists. One of the few was Horace Carter of Tabor City, North Carolina. Horace wrote a series of editorials for the Tabor City Tribune opposing the Klan.
I never wrote an anti-Klan editorial that I enjoyed writing. I wrote these editorials because, in my mind, that was a duty.
Much of the writing was met with threats to his paper, his family, and his life, but Horace Carter refused to back down. He passed away in 2009, but his legacy is alive, now in a documentary, The Editor and the Dragon. The film debuts on UNC-TV tomorrow night. Martin Clark and Walt Campbell have produced and directed the film, The Editor and the Dragon, and they join us now to talk about it. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Horace Carter starts writing these editorials, Martin, in the late 1940s. Tell us about Klan activity and what that looked like.
Well, at that point, the Klan had come back on the scene following World War II and had grown fairly steadily, hadn't really taken off in a big way. The Klan was coming out of Atlanta, Georgia. Grand Dragon Samuel Green was in charge of the whole Klan at that point. He died in 1949, and the Klan's splintered. There was sort of a power vacuum, and several people came in to fill it. And Thomas L. Hamilton is an individual who came in and formed the Association of Carolina Klans. And that is the Klan that then began to organize in South Carolina and try to move up into North Carolina. And this is the group that Carter encountered in the summer of 1950.
And, Walt, one of the more interesting things about Klan activity at this time, the civil rights movement is really getting started, but it's really underground. There's not a lot of power in that movement yet. And the Klan at that time focused its terrorist activities mostly on white folks, right?
In certain places, yes. And specifically in this case, that was what was happening in Columbus County for the most part, and in the adjacent Oree County in South Carolina. It was really acting as what it perceived as an enforcer of morals. You know, it's an interesting situation because what a lot of Klansmen perceived was that too many people were out drinking, running around, dating people they weren't married to, not taking care of their kids, not going to church. That type of thing was what they were really disturbed about. But the larger context, too, was that they were really afraid that what was going to happen was that the national government was going to make them go to school, black and white people together. And that was really sort of the pending cloud that was over things. But the way they took this out to some extent was to go after these people they perceived who were violating moral standards of the community.
And they would have rallies and they would have parades as they did in Tabor City. And that was a big focus of this. Tell us about those parades in Tabor City.
The motorcade, the Klan motorcade that drove through in the summer of 1950 in July, is the first encounter that Horace Carter had with this Klan. And these motorcades were largely recruiting endeavors. They would get about 30 cars together. They would burn their headlights and their interior lights. Typically, one of the cars would have a big electric cross attached to the front of it. And they would drive through town, usually just after dark, during a time in particular when they knew there would be a lot of people in the town. And in some of these farming towns, that ended up being Saturday night because that's when people would come to town to do their business. And this was one of the ways that they worked this whole area and made people aware of who they were. They had circulars. They would fire off sirens and fake gunshots and do things to get the people's attention and try to generate memberships in the Klan.
And of course, the Klan's activities were well known to everybody, but not always the membership. You have Don Hughes is somebody in your film who talks about seeing this motorcade go through town.
When the motorcade came through, we walked right on down to the edge of the street there, and I looked, and they came by, and I looked, and there it is, guys I knew riding in those cars. Had on those white outfits with that pointed hat, but they didn't have any cover over their face, and they had the inside lights on it. They wanted to be seen.
So then that rally follows an incident at Charlie's Place in Tabor City. How does Horace Carter cover that story?
Well, actually, it was Charlie's Place was a nightclub in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And one night in August, this Klan motorcade goes by Charlie's Place, mainly because the rumor was that Charlie was allowing mixed-race dancing in there. There was also booze being served, moonshine. There was gambling going on, and this is some of the moral infractions that we were talking about early. But they ride past Charlie's Place, and, you know, after that, what happens is somehow word gets back to the police that Charlie has said, now those guys better not come back here because we're going to show them who's boss. Well, the Klan gets that word. They head back to Charlie's Place, and they come in and they start firing. One of the first things they attack is they shoot the piccolo, is what it was called, the jukebox, because that was the music that signified sort of the racial crossover that was going on in the United States. There was a lot of music that was doing that. And then I think Marty wanted to say something probably a little bit about the music and other aspects of Charlie's Place.
Oh, well, this piece of the film, and anyone out there who's tried to put a film together in the past won't be surprised to hear, this piece of the film was initially about an hour long. We got so enthralled with the story of Charlie's Place. There were so many things going on that were of interest. And in particular, this was happening right at a moment when the big band jazz bands were scaling down into these smaller combos. And these combos were playing music that was called rhythm and blues, which eventually came to be called beach music because typically you would hear it in these clubs along the coast, typically black-owned and black-operated clubs. And the story of how the dancing was moving from the jitterbug jazz dancing to the big bands and morphing into what ultimately became the shag, along with other things going on in the story, we really kind of got stuck on Charlie's Place for a while and had to cut and cut and cut to bring it into context.
But what happens eventually is they come back, they shoot, they take Charlie, the nightclub owner, who was a wealthy man who did real well in Myrtle Beach. They take him out, they flog him, and this brings in the FBI. And it's really a crucial point in the whole unfolding of this story because they begin to investigate this Klan that they really didn't know much about that was led by Thomas Hamilton, the Grand Dragon. And they interview people that involved with the attack and that kind of thing. And that was an important turning point for us, too, in finding out for more information because there was an FBI report that we got through Freedom of Information Act that described all of this and the interviews with the people. So it was a critical, not only in because it was brought to the attention of the United States, the entire country, through headlines, but it was also a source of information for us.
And a revelation in this particular case because the episode at Charlie's ended with some shooting, including some Klan members, one of whom is taken to the hospital. When they take off his robes to treat him, he's in full sheriff's uniform. He's a cop. He's a local cop. And this comes as a surprise to people, right?
It does, and it did to us on some level, but the more you learn about the Klan and the Klan, particularly in that era, you find that it contained members of law enforcement, of the clergy, public officials. It really it appealed to a number of people, and they came from all areas of life.
So what happens now? Horace Carter, he starts writing about this. Tell us about. So how does he write about it, and you know what leads him to take what is a dangerous step, or was it dangerous? How did his town feel about the Klan?
He his work, the way he sees it in particular, and we heard a little bit of it in the clip, was that it was fundamental. He says he did not enjoy writing these anti-Klan editorials, but that he had to do it. It came from a sense of duty, a sense of public service in the press. He was compelled to deliver his opinions and his reporting. And in his editorials, we see a lot of him. We see a mix of his journalistic, democratic, constitutional, and Christian ideals, elements that for him really largely overlap and mix. He strongly urged rule of law. He was, of course, anti-vigilantism. And adhering to these constitutional values of equality and justice, and as he put it, love, understanding, and other principles that God would have us live together. So over a period of about 2 years, he authored a dozen of these anti-Klan editorials, along with about 100 news articles, reportage. And occasionally, it's interesting, his reportage veers a little bit into the opinion and sounding a little bit like an editorial. And interestingly, he also printed letters from the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, and he made it very clear that he would print any Klansman or Klan sympathizer's signed opinion submitted to his newspaper, and he did that on several occasions.
But they also sent other messages, didn't they? Tell us about the threats.
Well, we never got to see any actual pieces of paper because I think Harsh just threw them away. But he would said he continually had little pieces of paper put under, you know, in the windshield of his car that would threaten him. He would receive phone calls that said, "Oh, we're going to burn your house down. We're going to kidnap your kids." You know, it's really endearing, and but it was also complicated because, as Harsh says, in the film, at one point, he said, "Yeah, it'd have made a better story if I'd have got killed." And to some extent, yeah. I mean, that's not good. But in any event, that was part of what we had to do, was to figure a way to structure the story around all of these threats that he received and the high points and low points of those. And
threats to his business as well, boycott advertisers in his paper. And that's an interesting story. Who were the advertisers and why didn't they pull out?
Well, a lot of... the threat was that if Harsh did not stop writing these anti-Klan editorials, that what would happen is the Klan leader was going to urge all of his members to not go to any business that ran advertisements in Harsh's newspaper. So that would have knocked him down. A lot of the advertisement came from Jewish merchants who had stores in those areas, which was very important. That's probably one of the things that we didn't cover enough in this particular film, because we were so focused on the anti-black violence and that type of thing. But these were important merchants, and Horace was stuck up for them in many ways. He was the leader of the Christian portion of the annual fundraising for the Jewish community service, and he later received an important award from B'nai B'rith. So it was very important to this Jewish community that Horace stood up for this and said, "No, we're not going to have this."
So they didn't pull out. Where did he get all this? It was also important that he goes to the University of North Carolina and runs into Frank Porter Graham, right?
Yes, Frank Porter Graham was quite an influence on him. He lists Graham as one of the heroes in his life. For listeners who may not know, Graham was president of the University of North Carolina in the 1930s and 40s. And that afforded him a platform from which he became a nationally known figure, really one of the leading progressive liberals of his day. And he, of course, advocated in particular for human rights and human welfare and programs to address poverty and education and race and class issues. And I'll give you a quick anecdote. He was appointed to a number of boards and commissions and special committees by both Presidents Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman. At one point, when Carter was editor of the student newspaper, the Tar Heel, there was a group of trustees that were clamoring for Frank Porter Graham to step down off the War Labor Board because it was taking so much of his time and he was having to spend so much time in Washington working on it. Now, this was at the height of World War II, but these guys were calling for Graham to either come home or resign the presidency of the university. And so Carter ends up diving into this and writes an impassioned editorial supporting Dr. Frank, as he was known to students, and within a few days received a letter from none other than President Franklin Roosevelt, which read in part, "I know I can count on the University of North Carolina and the old North State to continue to let the nation share Frank Graham's wisdom and energies and the cause to which the state and the university have sent so many of their daughters and sons." So the trustees backed off, and Carter and Graham won the day. And the reason this is significant in Carter's life in particular is that he says that this is the event that established him as a crusading editor. Mm. It was his first editorial crusade, and he told us it really showed him the power power the press.
And it was a crusade that won him the Pulitzer Prize eventually, and unique in a way, because it was a small-town paper that won the Pulitzer, right?
It was, and it was shared by Willard Cole's newspaper, the Whiteville News Reporter also. But it received attention for a number of reasons. You know, and we're not certain why all of this attention, but a lot of it had to do with the fact that this was one of the first times, too, that the FBI had stepped in and attacked the Klan for civil rights issues. They really wanted to make a civil rights case against the Klan using one of these flogging episodes that had happened in and around Tabor City. So that was a critical point of it, you know, that J. Edgar Hoover finally had stepped in and done something with these agents. And so it received a lot of attention because of that. When, you know, he announced, Hoover did, in Washington, D.C. on the morning when agents were getting ready to arrest several of these Klansmen. It led to the arrest of 80 more Klansmen, prosecutions. So it looked like this frontal assault. So it drew the attention of the nation in a lot of ways, which facilitated attention for the Pulitzer Committee, too.
It's a fascinating story, and we can't wait to see. It's going to be on tomorrow night. Who are the partners in this film, in the production of this film?
Oh, sure. We worked with the Center for the Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina, and most especially the Films Advisory Committee that was organized by the center, and the family of Horace Carter. They cooperated with the making of the film. And the project just couldn't have happened without those groups giving all the help they did.
Martin Clark and Walt Campbell have produced and directed the film The Editor and the Dragon. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Frank.
The film is going to debut on UNC TV tomorrow night. And for more information, you can visit our website, stateofthings.org. Thanks for listening. Our program is produced by Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Wen. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, the news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.